Good. Okay. Lord, bless those kids as they learn about you. So we are in our third week of a series on parenting. And we've gone through the first 2 weeks describing why we're doing this when we know that it doesn't apply to every single one of us, although it is a subject that touches every single one of us in some way. And so if you'd like to kind of hear more about the reasons why we're doing this, there's a letter on the back table that we sent to the whole congregation about that. And you can pick that up on your way out. I'm not going to go through that material again since I did it the last couple of weeks. But we're in this in the third week. The last 2 weeks, we've looked a little bit at the background behind this. We've talked definitionally about what is the goal of parenting. And we said that it's nurturing the child's heart towards God, towards Jesus. That's the critical piece. And that one's really foundational. So if you weren't here for that one, I just encourage you to go on the website and maybe, you know, if there's any one that you did go back and listen to, that would be the one because it's really definitional. We're going to be coming back to that a lot throughout the rest of our time. And then last week we talked about the priority of parenting, about how parenting relates to the other aspects of our lives and how we fit that in and how really these things are all connected, our work life, our marriage, our friendships, and our, you know, parenting. These things are all intertwined. They're all interconnected. We like to separate them, think about them as juggling different balls, but they're more like concentric circles. They're all interrelated, and we need to approach them in that way. And again, that one's available for you too. But now we're going to really get into the meat of the how-to stuff, the tools. And I think you're going to see that even if you're not parenting right now, you're going to see a lot of these concepts, a lot of these principles apply to your life. They apply to your relationships with your friends and your parents. A lot of us grew up in situations where maybe the parenting wasn't what it could have been or should have been, and we have a lot of hurt around that and struggle. And I think it's helpful and healing, potentially, to hear about what a godly parent is like and to be able to say, okay, I didn't have that. And that hurts. I lost something there. But now I know what it is that I lost, and here's how I'm going to go and make up for that in my life in some other ways. And I'm going to focus on my heavenly parent, my Father in heaven, who can bring some of those gaps into my life. So this touches on all kinds of things. But what I want to do in the next few times is talk about the tools that we have for parenting from Scripture. You know, so much of parenting feels really out of control. And a lot of it is. Like, there's a lot of stuff that you can't control when you're parenting. There's just, you know, these are human beings. They have the ability to make choices, and they make choices. And it's really hard sometimes to live with that, and you just can't control everything. So what I'm hoping that we can do, though, is focus on the things that you can control. There are some things that we can do as parents, people working with children, that are concrete and that are helpful and that are good and that will bring blessing to the children that we're working with. And I've identified some of these. We're going to look at sheltering. That's what we're going to look at today. We're going to look at instructing, disciplining. That will be a fun one, I'm sure, an interesting one to talk about, disciplining. Speaking to children. And then the last one that we're going to look at is delighting in children. I love that song that we sang this morning about our Heavenly Father who delights in us. And that's such a hard thing for us to accept sometimes. And a lot of times the way a child learns to accept that is by experiencing that from their parents. Their parents delight in them. So I'm looking forward to that one very much. But the first one, like I say, is going to be sheltering. And I got the concept of this from a couple that wrote a book on something called Keeping Your Child's Heart or something like this. The Maxwells are their name, and they talk about sheltering. And so I did some biblical research on this and tried to think about, well, what is this concept of sheltering? And that's kind of what I want to unfold for us this morning. And if you don't have a Bible, I'd love to pass one out to you. We're going to be looking at Genesis 43 to start off with, Genesis 43. And that's on page 33 in the Bible that we're handing out. So raise your hand if you don't have a Bible. Love for you to be able to follow along in what we're looking at. And this is also a Bible that you can take home with you, the one that we give out to you. If you don't have a Bible, take it home with you. Love for you to have one at your fingertips in the house. The passage that we're going to look at here in Genesis 43 really gets to the heart of the concept of sheltering. And I was turned on to this passage by one of my favorite authors. Andrew Murray is his name. He wrote a book called Humility, and if you've talked to me very much, you've probably heard me talk about this book. He also wrote a great parenting book, and in it he talks about this concept of sheltering. He calls it the child's Andrew Murray's an old guy, so he says it's the child's surety, meaning their sponsor, their guarantee, somebody that protects them. And he uses this story of Judah as a wonderful example of what a child needs from a parent. He needs a sponsor, a guarantor. And let me get into the story a little bit. We're going to jump in. This is a long story, and we're only going to look at one piece of it. So let me kind of catch us up to speed. This is the story of Joseph in the book of Genesis. And what's happened so far is that Joseph is the younger brother. He's got some stepbrothers, and they don't like him. They're jealous, so they take him out one day, and they throw him into a well. They're going to get rid of him because they don't like him. And they decide that after he sits in the well for a little while, maybe it would be better to get some money out of the deal. So they pull him out of the well, and they sell him to some Egyptians, and Joseph becomes the slave of these Egyptians. And Joseph's story from that point continues on, and it's a remarkable story of this boy really being a slave, and through a series of circumstances, he sort of rises through the ranks in Egypt, and before you know it, he's become sort of the second in command in Egypt. He's the second most powerful person in Egypt after spending time in prison and being unfairly accused and all this kind of stuff. So that's the story of Joseph. Well, meanwhile, back home, the poor father of Joseph is bought by Joseph's stepbrothers a garment, the coat of many colors that belongs to Joseph, and they've covered it in blood, and they said, "Some ferocious animal ate your son, and he's all gone." And this is all we have left to show. And poor Jacob, Father Jacob, is heartbroken over the loss of his favorite son. He has one other son who's the brother of Joseph named Benjamin, not a stepbrother, the brother of the same mother with Joseph, and his name is Benjamin. Well, fast forward a bit. Joseph is in Egypt all this time, and Jacob and his family are living in a different place, and a famine comes on the land. And they have no food, and they have no way of getting food except to travel somewhere else and try to find food that somebody else might have. Now, Joseph has been working as second command, and he's stashed away tons of food for a famine. And so these brothers go down to Egypt, and they meet this man. They don't know it's their brother. They just know he's the second most powerful guy in Egypt, and they ask him for food. And long story short, he gives them some food. They go back. They have to leave a brother, but they go back, and the famine continues, and then they come back a second time. Only this time when they come back, they have to bring the littlest brother, Benjamin, because that man who is second command, who's really Joseph, says that if you come back, bring your littlest brother. I don't want to see you again unless you bring him. And you can see why he'd say that, right? These are the guys who threw him in a well and then sold him. And he's wondering what's happened to his little brother. And this is kind of where we pick up the story. They're still hungry. They need to go back to Egypt. They need to bring the little brother. And here's where we pick up in the action in verse 43, chapter 43, verse 1. Now the famine was still severe in the land. So when they had eaten all the grain they had brought from Egypt, their father said to them, "Go back and buy us a little more food." But Judah said to him, "The man," that is Joseph, but they don't know he's Joseph, they just know him as the man, "warned us solemnly, 'You will not see my face again unless your brother is with you.'" In other words, my little brother. "If you will send our brother along with us, we will go down and buy food for you. But if you will not," this is Judah speaking, "send him, we will not go down, because the man said to us, 'You will not see my face again unless your brother is with you.'" Israel, that's Jacob, asked, "Why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man," Joseph, "you had another brother?" They replied, "The man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family. 'Is your father still living?' he asked us. 'Do you have another brother?' We simply answered his questions. How were we to know he would say, 'Bring your brother down here'?" Then Judah said to Israel, Jacob, the father, his father, "Send the boy along with me, and we will go at once, so that we and you and our children may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety. You can hold me personally responsible for him. If I do not bring him back to you and set him here before you, I will bear the blame before you all my life. As it is, if we had not delayed, we could have gone and returned twice." Now, they go down. We're going to skip ahead to the next section. They go down and they bring Benjamin with them, and they stand before Joseph, and they have a great feast with Joseph. And they're about to leave, having their bags filled up, and they're going to go back, and they're going to be able to endure the rest of the famine. And they're just leaving Egypt, and one of the stewards of Joseph comes out and stops them, and he says, "You've stolen some of the goods that belong to Joseph." And lo and behold, what Joseph has done is he's sneaked a cup into the bag of his little brother Benjamin that belongs to the court there. And he's accusing him of stealing. And what he's really doing is he's testing his stepbrothers to see what they'll do in this situation. Faced with the loss of another brother, what will they do? And that's where we pick up the last part of the story. Turn over to chapter 44, verse 16. We're at this moment where Judah and the brothers are standing before Joseph. And Judah is shaking in his boots because here he is on the brink of losing now the second little brother, and you know his father's going to be absolutely crushed by this loss. "What can we say to my lord?" Judah replied, speaking to Joseph. "What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We are now my lord's slaves, we ourselves and the one who was found to have the cup." But Joseph said, "Far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you go back to your father in peace." Remember what Judah's promise was? Then Judah went up to him and said, "Please, my lord, let your servant speak a word to my lord," speaking to Joseph. He goes through the whole long story of what's happened to them and skip down to verse 30. He says this, "So now if the boy is not with us, when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety." When he says your servant, he's talking about himself. "Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father. I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please let your servant remain here as my lord's slave in place of the boy. So take me, in other words, instead of the boy. And let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? No, do not let me see the misery that would come upon my father. This is the most powerful moment in this part of the story when Judah steps up and he says, "Take me instead of my little brother." And it's the thing that breaks Joseph. Joseph is watching his brothers go through this and he can't take it anymore. And he just breaks down weeping. Because the thing that he didn't have, which was protection, right? His little brother is getting. Judah and his brothers have been transformed. They sold Joseph away, but now they're willing to sacrifice everything to protect this little boy. He's not a little boy at the time, but he's the little brother. And the point is this, and Andrew Murray makes this wonderful connection. He says, this is the role of the parent, is to be the protector, to be the one who ensures the safety, to the extent humanly possible, of the child that has been entrusted to his or her care. It's a basic principle. We create a space in which the child can develop and grow. That's what sheltering is. And at the very heart of it is at the heart that was at the heart of Judah. Whatever it takes, I'm going to protect this boy. And we're going to talk about the hows in a little bit. But right now we need to get this idea of the heart. The heart attitude of the parent or the one watching the children is that whatever it takes, I will do. I will make the sacrifice. It's a beautiful part of the way God has structured this world. I mean, think about the world that God created. Eaglets have nests, right? Foxes have dens, little fox kits, they call them. Chicks have their mother's wings. Jesus talked about Jerusalem. He wanted to bring them under his wing and protect them. It's part of the way God made this world, the sheltering concept. And it's the basic way that God relates to us spiritually too, not just physically. If you look at Israel in the early stages, God carved out a place for them to grow and to be sheltered from the influences of the nations around them so that they could become a nation fully devoted to them so that they would be strong enough to bless the rest of the world. That was the plan. It wasn't ever to keep them away from the rest of the world, but it was to provide a shelter, a place where they could become strong enough to then be a blessing to the rest of the world. And if you fast forward, you look at Jesus and the disciples, you know, he works with the disciples. He takes them away to bring them into a place where they can be away from everybody, to be sheltered so that they can grow and be strengthened, so that when he sends them out again, they will be able to engage with whatever they encounter, and they will come at it from a place of strength. Jesus prays at the end of John for our protection, that we would be sheltered, be protected. The apostles talk about protecting the weaker brother in the community of faith, the family of faith. So we see this built into the fabric of God's world. It's a beautiful part that there are stronger ones and there are weaker ones, and the stronger ones are to take care of the weaker ones. And that's to mean sacrifice oftentimes on the part of the stronger ones. The question is, how do you do that for human beings, though? Because we seem to be able to make things really complicated, right? We make our lives incredibly complicated. And we all sort of agree there's this concept of protection and sheltering, right? That's basic, it's understandable. But the struggle comes in, how do you live that out on a day-to-day basis in a complicated society where there are a myriad of influences and challenges coming into the lives of children, and you have them some of the time and you don't have them some of the time? How do you navigate that? That's the question we want to wrestle with this morning a little bit. And this is going to be like a work in progress, because this is a tough question. Some of us fall on one side and some of us fall. It's a continuum, right? Some of us are much more sheltering and some of us are much more sort of relaxed in the style dealing with children. I remember a while back I was looking at some CNN article on the web, and there was this couple that they were extremely upset because their child had been left in an airplane. They were supposed to be chaperoned in this airline. And, you know, they had a they had a transfer to make. And so the chaperone was supposed to meet them and take them from one plane to the other. And the chaperone didn't do that. And so this kid was left sort of stranded, you know. And the parents were on CNN, fuming, ready to sue the airline, you know, because they had failed in this endeavor. And the reporter asks, how old was this kid? And they say, 14. And I'm thinking to myself, 14, I mean, several generations ago, he'd be married practically at that age, right? He'd be running a farm and he'd have several kids. And you're worried about him making it from one airline to the other? That would be one side of the continuum, right? So I saw it last night. I think, okay, I'm going to look up, see if I can find that article about that story. So I'm looking up 14-year-olds' airplanes, and here's what I find. This illustrates the other side of the continuum. This is Fort Payne, Alabama. I wasn't going to say anything about you being from Alabama, but you just opened the door. Is that your hometown?
No, oh.
A 14-year-old boy stole a Cessna and went on a late-night joyride, taking off and landing twice before being arrested, police said. The teen suffered minor cuts and bruises on the second landing. That's pretty good. Because the plane came down hard, causing the landing gear to collapse and the propeller to dig into a road beside the airport, police said. The teen allegedly took his mother's van from their home Wednesday night and drove to the airport in Fort Payne. Last I remember, it was 16 when you start driving. About 5 miles away, he said he then found the key in the unlocked plane, removed the Cessna's tie downs, started the engine, and began driving around. So that's the other side of the continuum. It says he was, the other part, I saw another article, it says he was driving around and the plane started to lift off, and so he just went with it, just flew. So you have these parents on the one side of the continuum who are so sheltering, so protective that, you know, they're freaking out because their 14-year-old is in a public place, sheltered, and, you know, can't find his flight. And then you have the other side with this kid who sneaks out of the house and takes the airplane and flies around and does a couple of joyrides in it. And my guess is that the right angle is somewhere between those two. And so I want to talk about how we sort of navigate those tricky waters. And this is tough. I really wrestled with a lot of this. And this is a work in progress for me. I haven't got this figured out. And I probably don't have it figured out what I'm going to say. I mean, I know what I'm going to say, but this isn't the end of the matter, you know. There's a lot to this. It's a complicated kind of a thing. But I think we can stumble on some principles in navigating how it is that you shelter children in a way that is good and right, but not so much that you stifle their growth, right? Isn't that the question we have to figure out? So let's take some stabs at it. And again, there are no formulas for this, I don't think. We like formulas. There are no formulas for this kind of a thing. There are principles, right, that you think about and that you try to apply as best you can to your particular circumstance. But there's no formula. Okay, so here's some principles. I've got about five of these that I just want to kind of run through. The first one's going to be the big one, and then the other ones will be kind of shorter. The first one is this. Here's a principle I think we can take to the bank. In sheltering, what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a space where the pull towards Jesus is greater than the pull away. Okay? We're trying to create a space in this child's life, could be said of all of us, really, where the pull towards Jesus is greater than the pull away from Jesus. I think this is the concept behind Ephesians 6:5, which is one of the greatest parenting statements. It's so simple, so small, so incredibly full of meaning, though. When Paul says about two parents, he says, bring up your children in the training and instruction of the Lord. In other words, the dominant force in their upbringing is to be the training and the instruction of the Lord. The input, the greatest input into their lives is to be the training, the thing, stuff about the Lord. That's what you want to bring them up in. And there's not one way to do this. You can sort of, you know, proverbially skin this cat in many different ways. But as we do that, as we create a space, as we create a space for this to take place, here are some of the factors that we need to think through as we do this. First of all, you think through the home environment. So we're creating a space where the pull towards Jesus is greater than the pull away. We got to think about the home environment. That's the basic one, right? Is it strong or is it weak? And I'll tell you, here's what I think is it makes for a strong home environment. When the Word of God is opened in the community of the home on a regular basis, and kids are getting this sort of long-term, slow food, you know, feeding on the Word of God. And I think that you really can't expect that to happen unless you do that on a regular basis. You do that in the morning when the kids get up, just like we would do for ourselves, and you do it in the evening before you go to bed. And you've got this, you know, it's like in home group. We often talk about the Word is sort of like a fire. And you come around the fire and you warm yourselves around the fire. And the Word of God provides the topic, provides the instruction, provides the everything that you need to have a valuable discussion. And it's not like every night you're going to walk away and go, oh my goodness, my kids are transformed. They're totally saints now and everything's perfect and everything's great. But it's that you got to look at it in terms of the long term. It's like slow food. You keep feeding over the long haul and changes occur and they understand things. And some of the greatest places in Scripture to center on are the Proverbs. I'm doing that with my son right now, and it is amazing how these Proverbs speak directly to the things that our kids are dealing with. And then as a family, we're going through the book of Mark. And we don't take much. We just take a paragraph, not even a whole chapter, after dinner while we're sitting around the table, and we open talk about it. And sometimes it's really exciting, interesting, and they have lots of questions. Sometimes, you know, the ball doesn't get rolling. But either way, you know, we've sat in front of the Word, and we've allowed God to speak into our lives. And that is such a critical part. And it's taken me a really long time to get this into the fabric of our household. But I'll tell you, the benefits are just awesome and so wonderful. And so, you know, do it. I don't know what else to say. This is how you have a strong home environment. The second thing you got to consider is the school environment. And I want to pull over here because I know this is sort of the elephant in the room with a lot of us. You know, my family homeschools, okay? So then the question becomes, is homeschooling the right way to do it, you know, or not homeschooling? How do we think through this kind of a thing? And here's what I want to say. I'm going to just say, take 1 second on homeschooling. And we need to make a statement about this in our church because it's an issue that's out there. And that is this, is that you should homeschool if God has called you to homeschool. You should homeschool your kids if God has called you to homeschool. That's the only answer. It takes a ton of energy and effort. And if you don't feel the strong leading from the Lord that this is what you're supposed to do, then you will crump under the weight of it. And it won't go well. It'll be worse for the kids. I think each parent should look at the concept, study it through, ask the questions, and then make a decision and go with it. Those are my 2 cents on homeschooling. So this is a church that's not, you know, some churches get into this mentality where, oh, you only do this one particular way. We don't want that. There's lots of different ways to approach this. It goes back to the principle. Are we creating an environment where children's hearts are being pulled towards Jesus more than they're being pulled away from Jesus? So there's a lot of different ways to do that. The second thing you need to think about is the culture of the real world, that is the world surrounding you that you're a part of. So you think about the home environment, how is that influencing them? The school environment, think about that, because it's different in a lot of situations. And then the culture of the real world. My kids were playing instruments. They play on the street oftentimes, to raise money for different things, the violin and stuff. And they were on Telegraph one day, and the Breasts Not Bombs Parade came by as they were playing on the street. You know what the Breasts Not Bombs Parade is? It's you bare your breasts in protest of the bombs that are being dropped. And so then there were men who really didn't matter if they bared their breasts, so they were bearing other things. And this parade came marching by as the kids were playing on there. Now, that's a cultural artifact, right, of where we live. And that goes into considerations on parenting and how you address that. And the kids came bursting through the door. Dad! You'll never guess what happened. You saw a naked parade? No, I had no idea. Never would have guessed that. But it's part of the fabric of, you know, where we are. Interesting thing. And so the real world of the culture where we are has to be taken into consideration. To what extent does it manifest the principles of Christ? To what extent does it draw away from that? And I want to say about this too, though. You know, the immediate reaction then is, well, I want to take my kids away from a place where they're going to see naked parades, right? And go to somewhere where it's safe and everybody's the same and everybody believes the same things. And yet, we got to be careful about that too. Because how many kids have you known who've grown up in, you know, maybe suburbia where, you know, the big sort of, you know, mega church situation, and it's this really Christian culture, but it's very superficial. And the kids, in their desire to rebel, rebelled against that which was being forced on them. And so there's not necessarily safety. We have to think more deeply than just, you know, is it urban or rural? Are you in a blue county or a red county? You know what I mean? We have to think more deeply about these kinds of things. In terms of the effect that they have on our kids. I listened to a talk by Tim Keller, who's raised his kids in New York City, and they're now much older, in their 20s and 30s, I think. And they say, two of his kids say, they probably would have rebelled against Christianity had they not been in the rough-and-tumble environment of New York City, watching their parents grapple with tough issues, getting to know, you know, Christians. See, here's the thing. When you're in the suburbs a lot of times, the 20-year-olds aren't in the suburbs very much, right? They all go to the cities. That's where they like to be. And they said that one of the best things that we had as kids growing up, we always had people in the very next stage that we could look at who loved Jesus. And they were our models for us because they were part of the church. And our kids, they weren't ready to look beyond that to what it meant to be a parent. But they wanted to look to the 20s. And they had examples of people who loved Jesus through their 20s. And it was a very powerful model for them. And you think about, I mean, I could go on and on about this, but just all the diversity. I mean, if you want to raise a kid that will really understand the world and be able to interact, you know, why not raise them in a place where there's lots of diversity and you just have to grapple and wrestle with all these things? So that's an important piece to consider. It's deeper than whether it's just urban or rural. You've got to ask these questions about what is the culture bringing, how are we going to process that? And this is the thing that I come back to is all of this stuff that's coming in on our kids, we need to process through the biblical lens. That's what we need to do. Jody and I my wife had a great conversation about this. She said, you know, when you look at the media, the television that they're watching or the games that they're playing, so many of the things that happen in those, you know, the Proverbs speak to those things. If it's oversexed, the Proverbs speak to, you know, being modest. If in a particular show the kids are dishonoring the parents, you know, just incredibly, you know, the Proverbs speak to that. They speak to kids. And so we have to process these things that are coming into the kids' minds through Scripture and say, this is what the Bible says, And this is how it's different, because they aren't going to make that distinction without the help. Once they see it, the light bulb goes off and they say, oh yeah, that's right. I don't want to be like that kid who's dishonoring their mother and father. This is the way to go, and they can make that distinction. But we have to be processing those things through with them. And then the last factor that goes into this creating a space, I think, is taking into consideration the personality of the child. You may have a crowd follower type child, and that's significant. You may have what I call a hedgehog type kid, who you could put in any circumstance, and they're not going to bend or fold. They have their beliefs, and nobody's going to shake them. And that's the way he is. I had a guy in high school, his name was Sammer. He had big hair and just a different kind of guy in every single way you could imagine. And, you know, we would get into class and some subject would come up that he would disagree with. He was a strong Christian. You know, I sort of wanted to be cool and wanted to fit in with it. He'd stand up in the middle of class and just speak his piece, disagree with everybody in the whole classroom, and not have any qualm about it. It was a beautiful thing to behold. But he's a hedgehog, right? Not all kids are like that. Some kids are follower types, and they're going to get caught up in whatever is going on. And so that means the sheltering part that kicks in is now you as a parent are responsible to help shape the environment that they're going to be caught up in. So those are the four things that go into our home environment, school environment, the culture of the real world around us, and the personality. And what you want to do is you want to look at your particular situation and you want to build a plan, you know, based on these various different factors. If they're going to be out in an environment for most of the day where things are not going to be pulling them towards Jesus, then you want to bulk up in the house. You want to be really strong in the home and in your church involvement so that you can make sure and you know, shape that in the right way. I'm going to go on to the next one because we need to move through these. So the second thing, then, I'm looking at the life of Jesus and I'm thinking about how Jesus dealt with the disciples. He created that space, right? He created that space where the disciples could grow and learn. And one of the things that I love about the way that Jesus interacted with the disciples is he worked with them. He didn't say to them, you should do this, and then send them out on their own to figure it out. They were doing ministry together. They were walking around together, and they were encountering difficulties and challenges together, and they would wrestle through those. You know, here are these 5,000 people who need food. Well, what do we do? Okay, and they work it out, and Jesus is including them in the process. And I think the tendency for us sometimes is to say to our kids, you should do that, and now go do it. And we just send them out. And what really helps them and encourages them is if they get to be part of the process of living. We're facing the challenges that we face together, and we're taking it back to the Word. We're wrestling together through the moments of difficulty. As we, you know, close our Bibles at the end of our time, oftentimes the kids are a little mellow, and they'll say something about what happened in the day. And that provides an opportunity for us to process that together. Now, I could do one of two things. I could say in that moment, well, you should have done this. Why didn't you do this? And that's a temptation that we have, right? Or I could say, well, what do you think God would have you do in that situation? And then we could start processing it through. And the more that we have that approach with our kids, the more they're involved in it, and they can see us wrestling and struggling, and then they're equipped with the ability to do that processing afterwards. Very important. The same happens when you encounter difficult situations. I was at McDonald's with my son the other day, and we had a little extra time, so I said, let's get some ice cream. We were waiting between picking somebody up. And so we went through the drive-thru, got our ice cream, and we pulled into the parking place and stopped to eat our ice cream cone. And directly in front of us, sitting on the curb, no other cars, no obstructions, is a homeless man sitting right there. And this was a very hungry-looking homeless man. And so I'm thinking to myself, great, you know, we're going to have this moment of eating ice cream here, and we're just staring right at this guy. He's sort of staring back at us. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, what am I going to do with this? First thought was, I'll turn the car around. Then I thought, that's probably not the best idea in terms of modeling, you know, for my son. So I thought, okay, Lord, you're doing something here. So we enjoyed our ice cream, and I just was praying and said, okay, what do you want me to do about this? And then after I said, hey, what should we do? Should we should get some food for this guy there? And he goes, yeah, I think we should do that. So we went through the drive-thru again, and then we pulled back around, and I said, okay, it's your turn. It's your job to go and give it to him. Here's what I want you to say, you know, we wondered if you would like, I don't want you to presume that this guy wants anything from us, but just wondered if you would like. And he said, you want me to do it? You know? I said, yeah, this is good. This is right. And so he got out of the car and he walked over and I'm looking at the guy and I'm thinking, you know how when you've given something away to somebody and, you know, they like take a swing at you or, you know, I'm wondering what's he going to encounter, you know, when he does this. Oh, Lord, please give him I want this to be a good experience. And so he walks up and he says it and I just see the guy's face light up as big as day. And he says, it was just perfect. He says, oh, thank you so much. Thank you, you know. And Elijah came back in the car, and he was just glowing, of course, you know, because it was a challenge that he'd overcome. But he was involved in this. This is what I'm saying, is this is a process, and we involve the kids in the process of what does it mean to live like Jesus where we are. And we don't just tell them and send them out. We work on it together. We're a team. That's what Jesus did with the disciples. And it's a beautiful process. And that brings up a third thing, that the challenges that come need to be incremental. If my youngest son, who's 4 and a half, were sitting there, I would not have said to him, go out and bring that food to that man, right? That would have been entirely too scary for him at that point. But Elijah, who's 11, and by the way, I asked him if I could share these things, so he's ready to do it because that's the next challenge that he needs. And I think we get frustrated with trying to understand the challenge that our kids need oftentimes. And so we like to just get a formula. Again, we say, you know, I'm just going to let him experience the world and whatever happens, happens. And blah, you know, we'll just deal with it. And it'll be great. And then others of us say, you know what? Nothing is good. I'm going to shelter him from everything. And you know, we end up sheltering him from things that they need to experience. And the real question is this. The real question is this. That we have to be asking ourselves. And it changes every stage of the way. We have to ask the question, what can this child handle at this time? What is going to be the proper resistance so that they'll grow? What will be enough of a struggle to cause them to grow, but not too much to break them? That's the question. And what's so hard about that question is it's changing all the time. From one stage to the next, it's changing. And what you didn't allow them to do, now you must free them to do and experience and maybe fail and challenge it. So we got to go. And Jesus did that, right? The disciples, he takes them away, he teaches them, you know, he sends them out and then brings them back in and they process that the first time. And then at the very end, after he's trained them and let them fall some hard ways and struggle, then, you know, he goes to heaven. He says, you know, I'm going to help you, but now you carry this ministry on. You see that process in the way Jesus disciples. So incremental, we got to let challenges in on an incremental basis. Then fourth one is prepare to sacrifice. As parents, as people working with children, we need to prepare to sacrifice. Judah, in this story that we read, was all in. He said, take me instead. Whatever it takes, that's my mentality. Whatever it takes. And in parenting, there are some really hard decisions that have to be made. Sometimes it's unpopular to say, I don't think it's a good influence for you to spend so much time with this person right now. Someday I hope that you'll be able to minister to them, but you're not doing that now. You're just getting sucked into their view of things, and you need to make a separation. That's an unpopular thing to do. It's a sacrificial thing to do as a parent because it's hard to do. Sometimes we have to, and I told you this story a while back, that you know, sometimes we have to sacrifice our own hobbies, our own work time, our careers a little bit, to be able to spend that extra time. And God has had to really use a big sledgehammer with me to bring that about. But he is doing it, and he has done it. And the benefits are just, I wouldn't trade him for the world. Wouldn't trade him for the world. And sometimes that sacrifice needs to be made, and maybe that's the place where you are. You know, it's interesting. We really just patterned this after one of Judah's descendants. Judah had this sacrificial attitude, but way down the line, there was another man in the line of Judah named Jesus. And he wanted to bring his children to the Father. And that entailed him making the greatest sacrifice. And we sang about that this morning, that he was willing to lay down his life. He was all in to do whatever it takes to bring his children back home. And as a parent, time and time again, that is the source of our strength, the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, the work of Jesus Christ, the model, the example of Jesus Christ. And Judah is just sort of a, you know, he prefigures the great example, who's Jesus Christ, who makes that sacrifice. Last thing is this. Remember the well factor, the cistern factor. Despite our best efforts, sometimes we can't shelter our kids. Sometimes they get thrown in a well and sold to Egypt. And it's hugely painful. And we've tried to do everything that we could, and it didn't work because we're not in control of this world. And in those moments, we need to remember the principle of the well. Jacob lost his son, but God hadn't given up. And he took that son, and when he was sold into slavery, and he brought him through a series of circumstances that trained him and built him up, and he used that son who was lost, who didn't get sheltered, to be the salvation of their family. It doesn't always work out the way that we expect or want to. But thank God that we have a God who's big enough and good enough to redeem in broken situations. We're going to take some time to have communion together this morning, like we always do. And